I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a minister and a rabbi walk into our studios. We'll have their conversation about the commercialization of the holidays. But first, members of the Senate Intelligence Committee have vowed to conduct a review of the destruction of two CIA interrogation tapes. CIA Director Michael Hayden acknowledged in a memo to employees yesterday that the tapes had been destroyed. The New York Times reports today that the videotapes, interrogations of two al-Qaeda suspects in CIA custody, were recorded in 2002 and destroyed in 2005, and they showed CIA operatives subjecting the detainees to severe interrogation techniques, including waterboarding, controlled drowning. The news raises questions about whether the CIA obstructed justice or withheld information from Congress, the courts, and the September 11th Commission. Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for the New York Times, broke the story, joins us now. Mark, to that question first, what is your conclusion about whether the CIA obstructed justice?
Well, I think it's too early to draw firm conclusions. All we have at this point statements that are a little bit contradicting each other. Members of the September 11th Commission insist that they requested all documentary evidence of CIA detainees, and yet were never told of any videotapes. The CIA says that the 9/11 Commission never asked specifically for tapes, so that's in question right now. The other question is, in terms of the courts, the CIA made declarations in the case of Zacharias Moussaoui that they did not have videotapes, and they say that the court never specifically asked for the tapes that they had in their possession. And then finally, the question of when Congress was notified. Last night, the two top members of the House Intelligence Committee in 2005, when the tapes were destroyed, took issue with the CIA director's statement. The CIA director had said yesterday that Congress was notified before the tapes were destroyed. They said that absolutely was not the case.
By the way, Moussaoui, one of the detainees you mentioned, was the so-called 20th 9/11 attacker, and Abu Zubaydah was another detainee allegedly on these tapes. He was the first detainee in CIA custody. By the way, you've also got two accounts in your report as to why these tapes were destroyed.
Well, that's right. Several current and former officials that we talked to said that there was a tremendous concern at the time for any kind of legal jeopardy that these tapes might put CIA operatives in. Recall that this is not too long after Abu Ghraib and the incredible controversy that was swirling after that, and there was concern that any kind of documentary evidence would be not only embarrassing but could put people in legal risk. It was also a time that the Congress was looking seriously at the CIA program. CIA Director Hayden said yesterday that the primary reason that they did it was to actually protect the safety of CIA officers, that if these were to get out, they could be opened, that the operatives in the tapes could be vulnerable to any kind of retaliation by al-Qaeda.
But as you said, officials told you, it seems off the record, that there was fear also of exposing these officials to legal risks.
That's correct. The best we can say at this point is that in 2003, a year after the tapes were made, members of the agency went to members of Congress sort of to present them with these tapes, or at least say that they had the tapes. And clearly in 2003, they were concerned about just what they should be doing with these tapes.
Well, we know that last night, House and Senate negotiators agreed to legislation that would ban CIA agents from using waterboarding, this drowning technique. We know that goes against President Bush's demand that the CIA be exempted from that legislation. How is this story going to impact that debate, do you think?
It's a good question. President Bush has said that he is not going to allow the CIA to be forced to use the same methods as military interrogators, the so-called Army Field Manual, which is a far less tough a slate of interrogation methods. He says the CIA needs these, what they call enhanced interrogation methods. So currently, as it stands, anything that came from Congress requiring CIA to use the same thing as the Pentagon probably would get vetoed by the president. Now, with this story coming out today, we will see whether that changes the dynamics at all. But both President Bush and CIA Director Hayden are certain to fight that legislation vigorously.
Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for the New York Times. Mark, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Tonight, Jews around the world will light the fourth candle in their menorahs to mark the fourth night of Hanukkah. The eight-day celebration honors the ancient battle in which Jews defeated an army intent on assimilating them into Greek civilization. In their Jewish temple, only enough oil to light the eternal flame for one day, but miraculously, the oil burned for eight, as the legend goes. Well, traditionally, Hanukkah was a minor holiday, but according to our next guests, the pressures of Christmas have turned Hanukkah, for some families, into a major shopping headache, and those pressures have hurt Christmas as well. Joining us in the studio, Rabbi Joshua Elkin, Executive Director of the Partnership for Excellence in Jewish Education. Welcome.
Nice to be here, Robin.
And we also welcome to our studios Pastor Mary Ludi of the First Church in Cambridge, United Church of Christ. Pastor Ludi, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much, Robin. Thanks.
Full disclosure, I have attended your church. And Rabbi Elkin, I want to start with you. And I know you won't mind if I ask, do you feel that Hanukkah has been too commercialized and maybe too fraught with some Christmas traditions?
Well, I think it has been commercialized. I think there's a lot of marketing that goes on around it. I think that there's a sense that somehow Hanukkah has to be made to be the Jewish Christmas, and in reality, it really is a minor holiday on the Jewish calendar. Nonetheless, I think people work very hard to try to recapture the message of the holiday, and the message of the holiday is being a holiday that marks religious freedom, marks freedom from oppression, and also a sense of being able to survive as a minority in a majority culture.
Well, has it become a holiday in which you're expected to receive a new Nintendo Wii? You know, what was the gift-giving supposed to be on Hanukkah?
Well, I think originally, if we roll it all the way back, Hanukkah was actually a belated Jewish Thanksgiving that is on the calendar right now as Sukkot. And the Jews couldn't get into the temple because it was under control of the Greeks. So they observed this Thanksgiving. So originally, it was exactly the reverse. Instead of receiving gifts, it was an idea of giving thanks to God.
And what's been the traditional Hanukkah gift? It's a coin, a gold-covered chocolate coin.
Hanukkah gelt. Coins, and there are chocolate coins and things like that. And that is definitely the traditional gift. And that's been going on for hundreds of years, I believe, but not all the way back to the beginning.
Yeah, so gelt is Yiddish for money. So are you feeling embattled?
Look, I have the Boston Globe here, which I looked at last night. Page 3, there's a picture of a whole lighting of the menorah. In many cases, we've arrived. Judaism is so accepted. And yet I think that as someone who works in Jewish day schools and works with people involved in the synagogue community and so forth, there is a sense that our numbers are small, and we want to try to impress upon our numbers what a beautiful tradition we have year-round, and to have people feel that it's worth staying connected.
Mary Luda, you've been nodding through all of this.
Right? Yes, I have. Because it's a familiar story.
But here you are, the Christian. Are you feeling your holidays also embattled?
Well, in a way I do. It sounds odd, I think, because we do come from the majority religious culture, and one would think that we wouldn't feel embattled at all because, after all, it's all about us and Christmas and our own story. But I think anybody who has taken a good look at it realizes that the commercialization of Christmas has really made it hard even for Christians to celebrate Christmas in the way that the tradition and the story demands of us. It's nothing new, of course. I mean, this commercialization has been something preachers have been complaining about for centuries. I mean, I'm from a Puritan origin church, and we have documents from Puritan preachers that were railing against the commercialization of Christmas in the early 17th century.
Huh.
What has happened is that the scope of commercialization, the spread of it, the comprehensive nature of it has really made it almost impossible for us to do anything other than celebrate Christmas from, you know, October until December 26th, till the morning after, but not celebrate it as Christmas, celebrate it as a kind of cheery, superficial, sweet little season, which, of course, in lots of ways, it's not.
Well, tell us about that, because you say the original intent of Christmas, of course, the birth of Jesus. You say original intent. I'm thinking I've just been watching Amal and the Night Visitors, the wonderful opera. We're going to have a story on it. And, you know, the kings were bringing incense and myrrh and all this stuff. I mean, it seems like it was always about all these big deal gifts.
I think that's true. Gift giving has always been a part of the festivity of Christmas because in the end it celebrates, in our traditional theology anyway, the self-gift of God to humanity, the idea that God shares God's own life with us. And so to share that with each other, has always been part of the deal. But much like the rabbi was saying, it has now become the point rather than, in a sense, a demonstration that we get the point, which is that self-gift and community life and living together in a spirit of love and reconciliation and forgiveness and mercy is really the point. And so we've substituted the what could be a token of the meaning for the meaning itself.
How do you reverse this thinking on the part of kids?
There's a real effort to try to recapture the meaning levels of the holiday. I think there's a lot of emphasis on wanting to see the beauty in the tradition that exists year-round. I know Mary and I were talking about this before, that each of our religions have a year-round cycle that we can plug into. But I'll give you one example that I'm familiar with from a Jewish day school in New Jersey area that a number of years ago, they decided that as a school they wanted to do something to sort of take on the issue of the getting and receiving and the pressure to receive and kind of turn the tables. And what they did is they made the eighth day of Hanukkah a giving day, and they instituted a campaign to raise funds and then have the kids get involved as part of the Hanukkah celebration in deciding where those funds should go and what the needy causes are. So they tried to have sort of, instead of just a getting every day, that a giving and a giving back.
Did it work, though? Because we're hearing anecdotally, you know, stories in the office of, and I hope I'm not revealing too much, a family where the parents on every night, an iPod, iPhone, Xbox, whatever the things are, every single night this huge gift, in part because they feel like they have to, it's boosting the faith, you know, yes, your religion is as good as theirs. You're nodding yes, Rabbi. You hear that?
I think I feel very badly that families get into that. And it's, in many cases, it ends up being quite costly. And it can never be enough. I mean, there's so much that's out there, and so many families have the capacity to be able to do these acquisitions night after night. I think one of the things that families try to do is try to create some kind of a balance between the getting-receiving nights and the giving nights. And the nights of just being together and celebrating family time and being together with the warmth of the candles and to just feel the spiritual messages and the historical messages and the contemporary messages of cherishing a tradition and being able to celebrate the beauty of a heritage that's year-round.
That's Rabbi Joshua Elkin. He's Executive Director of the Partnership for Excellence in Jewish Education. We've also been speaking with Pastor Mary Luty of the First Church in Cambridge, United Church of Christ here in Massachusetts. Just ahead, reclaiming the spirit of giving. Charlie Brown was concerned about all of this back in 1965.
What's going on here? What's this? Find the true meaning of Christmas when money, 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 spectacular, super colossal, neighborhood Christmas lights and display contest. Lights and display contest? Oh, no. My own dog gone commercial. I can't stand it.
And speaking of kids, on Monday, foster kids, foster care for kids. Should the government seize the funds of kids who go into foster care to help pay for that care? That's on Monday, but we'll be back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Rabbi Joshua Elkin, Executive Director of the Partnership for Excellence in Jewish Education, and Pastor Mary Luty of the First Church in Cambridge, United Church of Christ here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They've had some thoughts about the commercialization of the holidays. And we went to a local shopping center here in Boston to get an idea of what kids are hoping for this holiday season.
I'd like an iPod for Christmas.
I want a Chanel purse and a Coach purse.
Play-Doh and stuff like that.
DVD player and a camera.
A lot of Scooby-Doo things. I asked for a Scooby set, a Scooby-Doo little game, and I asked for a Scooby-Doo toothbrush, and a Scooby-Doo what, Mom? Do you remember?
Okay, Scooby-Doo, and there was someone there in there with Play-Doh, but there was a child asking for a Coach bag, and very expensive handbags. Mary Luty, what do you do to offset that?
Well, I think it's very, very difficult for families to resist these pressures, especially when they try to go it alone. Individuals and individual families simply cannot stand up to Madison Avenue. It's just way too seductive. Everything is commercialized, not just Christmas and Hanukkah, but breakfast cereals. And so we have to teach ourselves disciplines of waiting and of focusing our desires on things that are deep and eternal and that matter, not just by railing against consumerism and commercialization of Christmas and saying it's all bad and wrong, but to really try to help people develop habits of resistance that are communal as well. So that, for example, in our community, we practice Advent, which is the 4 weeks before the celebration of Christmas Day itself. It's in that time that we contemplate our own longing, our own desire, for life and for reconciliation and peace, for all the things that Christmas is supposed to stand for. And we try to get in touch with the sort of almost naked human need that we feel for more than material objects and stuff in our closets, but for something that can satisfy us much more deeply. And so that's what Advent is about.
You know, Rabbi, for Jews as well, there's a particular interest in trying to hold on to your traditions, because we're reading a statistic that it's according to the United Jewish Community's National Jewish Population Survey. 70% of Jews in the U.S. who married in 2001 married non-Jews. Mm-hmm. That's up from 13% before 1970, when it was rare. How much is that also part of what you have to deal with, these, you know, interfaith marriages where a couple may be sort of doing this delicate dance of what do we do at the holidays?
One of the real concerns is the fact that in many of these families, the desire to hold on to both traditions creates a sense that you observe Hanukkah and Christmas. It's a tough road to go when you have both of those traditions together, unless you believe, and I do not believe this, unless you believe that there is some kind of a synthesis of these two traditions that's going to somehow develop over time. I think that they're both beautiful traditions, but they're different. And I think that one of the challenges is to try to excite these families about the beauty of a tradition that's year-round, about amazing festivals, amazing holidays, starting with the Sabbath, which comes every week, but the New Year's, the Passover holiday, the holiday of Purim.
But you get to this time, and it seems like every well-intentioned plan falls away because we were reading stories recently in the New York Times of an interfaith family. She was Jewish, he was Catholic, sort of having this subtle competition. You know, she would ask in advance what the kids wanted and then get the gifts for Hanukkah as sort of like defending faith in the face of, well, a couple weeks later, there's Christmas. I mean, Mary, do you hear this from congregants? Or
we don't have a great number of congregants who have interfaith marriages. What I do see is when we have that situation is that they will choose one tradition. The other thing which just happens is they reduce both festivities to a kind of lowest common denominator and go for the general themes of the holiday rather than the particularities of each festivity, which are so just so alluring and so wonderful, each in their own way. In our own congregation, what families are starting to do is to pay careful attention to all the alternative ways that you can give gifts by, for example, making charitable contributions in lieu of a gift, or attending one of these alternative Christmas fairs like we have in our church, where people can buy meaningful gifts made by people who actually need the resources that we're able to give them by purchasing their goods and their crafts and all the rest.
They are such good words, and I'm going to try to hold on to them. And yet, how do you tell a parent back away from the Xbox?
Well, I don't tell them to back away from it. What I try to do more than anything else is to help people find within themselves the spiritual resources to deal with the consequences of these decisions. We're talking about a response to pressures that are not coming from their child, but are coming from, you know, advertisers, commercial people who have great power, great wealth. I think one of the things that troubles me the most about it is how the consequences of these decisions often make people depressed. The excess of choice, the waste that's involved in the spending that we do. We see people who are spending money on things that not only do they not need, but they can't afford. And I think that debt and depression and all the rest, not unseen in this season. What does that say about a Christmas that leads people to feel really terrible?
The challenge of materialism in general, I think, is, this is kind of, it reaches a kind of a feverish pitch at this season. But I think it's something that that all religious faiths, I think, have to contend with as to what's our purpose being here in the world, do we have in Judaism? We have an expression, tikkun olam, which is the Hebrew for repairing the world. What's our obligation for doing this and for attending to the hungry and so forth? And there are efforts at this time of year. There's an outfit in California called Mazon, which means food, which is a Jewish response to hunger, which encourages people to give money to Mazon and to let people know that a gift to Mazon was given in your honor. Instead of giving you a gift, it was given in your honor to do good. That comes from this inside of saying, what are we supposed to be doing here on the earth? What's our mission here? And is it about accumulating objects, or is it about somehow trying to create a better world?
That's Rabbi Joshua Elkin. He's Executive Director of the Partnership for Excellence in Jewish Education. We also spoke with Pastor Mary Ludi of the First Church in Cambridge, United Church of Christ, right here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Rabbi Elkin, happy Hanukkah.
Thank you so much.
and Mary Ludi, a Merry Christmas
Thank
in advance.
So thanks a lot.
Okay, still ahead, former CIA analyst Ken Pollack. He was wrong on Iraq, so why should we believe new reports on Iran? That's after the news, here and now. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said today that the U.S. would continue to press for sanctions against Iran while not ruling out diplomatic efforts from other countries. Policymakers have been huddling since the National Intelligence Estimate, which was released this week, said that Iran halted its nuclear weapons program in 2003, a dramatic reversal of the 2005 NIE that said Iran was relentlessly pursuing nuclear weapons. Kenneth Pollack is director of research at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. He's also a former Iran-Iraq military analyst for the CIA. When we called him earlier this week, he said he was skeptical of the new report. He wondered if a new source could have been developed so quickly. Well, since then, there's been news that the new estimate was based on military notes obtained last summer from a meeting of Iranian generals, which allegedly showed that they were complaining bitterly about their superiors' decision to put a halt to the weapons development program in 2003. Well, we called Ken back and asked for his reaction.
Well, I do think that the information that has been released has helped assuage my concerns. You know, the history of American intelligence operating against Iran, at least since the 1979 revolution, has been, quite honestly, that our information about Iran has been terrible. The Iranians have very consistently been able to figure out who our agents were and roll them up, and it has been a real rarity that we ever got information of this kind of quality. So my going-in assumption was, you know, boy, the U.S. has never had intelligence like this, and I was wondering why it was that the intelligence community felt like it had so much confidence in these judgments. You know, I'm someone who has repeatedly warned against military operations against Iran because, frankly, I don't think that we have the information to know what their nuclear program looks like enough to be able to successfully bomb it.
You've said that Iran is one of the most complicated political systems in the world. There's the highly visible president, Ahmadinejad, but he's not as powerful as the supreme leader. And, of course, then there's the military, the elite Quds Force, which the White House is calling a terrorist group, and then the military in general. And we're hearing about these generals complaining about the end of the nuclear program. So who's in charge?
Well, at the end of the day, the supreme leader, the Rahbar, Ali Khamenei, clearly is in charge. The problem creeps in because he is a very weak man in a very strong position. And Iran is a deeply fragmented political system. What you see from Khamenei is that he tries to balance all of Iran's different factions by trying to give each one of them half a loaf. Oftentimes, they seem to be moving in several directions simultaneously because Khamenei is trying to appease all of these different factions at once.
Do you have concerns that, for instance, these generals are complaining bitterly about the end of the program? I mean, we know that Iran is still processing uranium. They say it's for energy use only, civilian use only. Who has access to that?
This is one of the, I think, many big unanswered questions of the unclassified version of the NIE. And it gets really to Iran's intentions. It may be that the NIE, its classified version, does talk a great deal about what the intelligence community believes in Iran's intentions are, but the unclassified version is remarkably quiet on that matter. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that is in the NIE and that we do know about Iran doesn't really seem to add up. The intelligence estimate is saying we now have very good evidence that indicates that the Iranians did have a weaponization program, but they stopped the weaponization part of it in 2003. And that leaves open the question of why. Were they frightened of the United States? I mean, let's remember, in 2003, we had just invaded Iraq. It's clear the Iranians were very frightened. They also were just starting to feel the threats of sanctions from the Europeans. Maybe the Iranians decided, you know what, we should just go for nuclear power. Let's forget about this whole nuclear weapons thing. But the NIE says nothing about any of that.
Well, so now you have Iran still enriching uranium. They say it's for energy purposes, even though they're a huge oil producer. So what do you think should happen now?
Well, I think that you've put your finger on it, which is that on the one hand, you do have Iran attempting to acquire a uranium enrichment capability, which would give it the capability to build nuclear weapons in the future. On the other hand, it does suggest that Iran is susceptible to pressure. It does suggest that the Iranian leadership are not a bunch of maniacal zealots who simply want to get a weapon and blow up the world. In addition, this report is going to further muddy the waters with the international community. The Bush administration had frightened a lot of people with its talk of war, and on the other hand, they had actually done a reasonably good job in putting together a coalition of countries willing to bring increasing levels of pressure against Iran to get them to stop their uranium enrichment program. This report is going to make things even more complicated.
Well, having said that, should the Bush administration, in your opinion, move towards talks with Iran?
We need to sit down and talk to the Iranians. As many people have said before me, it is often more important to talk to your enemies than it is to talk to your friends.
Ken Pollack, before we let you go, what's happening in the analyst world right now, which you're a part of? You, for instance, were for the invasion of Iraq because you believed that Saddam Hussein had reconstituted his weapons program. How much is who was for what in Iraq clouding or informing how analysts are now looking at this reversal in intelligence that's coming out about Iran?
Yeah, I think that's actually a very important point. As a former intelligence officer and someone who also had to do a lot of reexamination of his views and soul-searching after I realized that I had gotten it wrong about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program, as so many others did, what strikes me about this NIE is that it does seem very much to be a reaction to the criticisms of the U.S. intelligence community from the whole Iraq fiasco. And there were two principal criticisms of CIA and the other intelligence agencies. One was that they started out with an analytic framework, and they tried to fit every piece of information that came in into that analytic framework, and if it didn't conform to that analytic framework, they threw it out. The response in this NIE seems to have been to not really have an analytic framework. This is the first NIE I have ever seen that begins with a really sensational piece of information rather than an overall judgment about what the intelligence community thinks is going on. It's almost the intelligence community saying, here's all the information, you guys can figure out what it all means. The second criticism, of course, was that they didn't stand up to the Bush administration and say that the administration was exaggerating their intelligence assessments. And so here as well, this seems to be a case of the intelligence community standing up and saying, you said that we weren't strong enough in saying things that the Bush administration didn't like. Well, boy, here's one that the Bush administration isn't going to like. And it simply means that we're in a very new world when it comes to intelligence analysis. In addition, while I'm very much in favor of greater declassification of information and a greater willingness to share with the public what the U.S. government is thinking, I got to tell you, I've got some questions about the wisdom of immediately declassifying NIEs, because it means that for the first time, the CIA and other intelligence agencies are no longer writing for the U.S. government. They're now writing for the world. And that's going to change the nature of what the intelligence agencies are able to say. And it may mean that what they say is not nearly as useful to the U.S. government.
That's Kenneth Pollack, Director of Research at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. He's a former CIA analyst and author of The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America. Well, coming up next week, Oprah hits the campaign trail. Republicans debate immigration. We'll cover both those stories. You're listening to Here and Now. Ceremonies are being held today marking the 66th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941. The number of veterans from World War II dwindles every day. Here Now's Alex Ashlock wanted to note the recent deaths of two recipients of the Medal of Honor.
They were regular guys who did extraordinary things. On January 31, 1943, 21-year-old Jefferson DeBlanc was flying his Wildcat fighter over the Solomon Islands, protecting American dive bombers attacking Japanese ships. Japanese fighters intercepted them, and DeBlanc shot down five of them in a furious dogfight before his own plane was hit, a bullet shearing the watch off his wrist. He bailed out into the Pacific, swimming for 6 hours, coming ashore on the Japanese-held island of Kolombangara. After several days, he was seized by a group of tribesmen. His luck turned, though, when he was rescued by a local man who traded the tribesmen a 10-pound sack of rice to set DeBlanc free. After the war, DeBlanc taught school for many years in his hometown of St. Martinville, Louisiana. A few years ago, he went back to the Solomon Islands and found the man who had rescued him with that bag of rice. Jefferson DeBlanc died in Lafayette, Louisiana on Thanksgiving Day. He was 86. On March 15, 1945, 27-year-old Private Silvestre Herrera was treading along a road in the woods of France when his platoon was caught in the crossfire of two German machine gun nests. The other GIs dove for cover. Herrera charged the closest enemy position. He took out the guns with grenades and captured eight German soldiers. Under heavy fire from the second machine gun nest, Herrera charged alone again across what turned out to be a minefield. Both of his feet were blown off at the ankle, but he kept firing, allowing his unit to skirt the minefield and capture the second enemy position. Herrera was a Mexican citizen when he was drafted. He is believed to be the only person to hold the highest Mexican and American medals for bravery in combat. When he came home from the war, he worked as a leather craftsman in the Phoenix area. An elementary school there is named after him. Silvestre Herrera died on November 26th. He was 90. There were 464 Medals of Honor awarded during World War II. Just 32 of the recipients are still alive.
Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. And that's The Soldier Song, one of two songs written by Babyface for his new CD playlist. As we take a minute to catch up with your letters, we begin with a comment on our interview with Babyface. I pointed out that all the songs he picked to cover were from white artists. Well, Julia Rodriguez of Durham, New Hampshire wrote, "I really enjoyed the story, but I was disappointed at the implication that an R&B musician would want to cover white music. Doesn't music belong to everybody? And by the way, the songs you sampled made it clear he's improved every one of them." Well, we also aired a segment this week with author Damon Linker, a non-Mormon who spent 2 years teaching at Brigham Young University. Damon asked whether a Mitt Romney presidency would take directions from leaders of the Mormon Church or be impacted by his Mormon belief in the return of Christ. Well, Anne Frost of Mesa, Arizona wrote, "The Mormon doctrine is that Christ's return will be dramatic and undeniable. Should a faction of Mormons just decide one day that Christ had returned, Romney will be quite safe to ignore them without jeopardizing his standing in the church. P.S., I'm a lifelong Mormon who's not planning on voting for Romney because I don't believe that his stance against abortion is in agreement with my beliefs. Mormon founder Joseph Smith taught that leaders should teach correct principles and let the people govern themselves." Professor Max Stanton wrote from the Hawaiian branch of the Mormon-run Brigham Young University to say, "You said blacks were allowed in the church in 1978. Well, blacks have long been members of our church. They were allowed to be priests in 1978. I remember one of my students, a Zulu from South Africa, contacted me. We were both ecstatic." And Chris Kite of Cornelius, North Carolina, made the same point, adding, "I would also refer you to Mitt's father, George Romney's, support of civil rights during the 1960s, despite a church leader's opposing view." Then, in that wonderful non sequitur way so many of you have, Chris threw in a link to his daughter's website. She's Andrea Frank, a harpist in Houston, Texas. Enjoy. Send your thoughts to here-now.org. Back with the Carpenter Poets, Here and Now. Some tradesmen in Boston are taking a cue from the cowboy poets. They're writing about what they do. As Here and Now's Andrea Shea told us earlier this year, they're carpenter poets, crafting works such as Death-Defying Postures and Another Missed Mitre, and sharing them at the local watering hole. Now the carpenter poets have self-published a book of their work. It's called Break Time. So we thought we'd revisit the bards of the boards.
A crew of men perch on scaffolding that hugs the exterior of an old house in Boston.
Got that nail gun?
Inside, Carl Weinhardt of Rocksteady Builders takes a break. He's been a carpenter for 33 years and, on and off, also a poet, dabbling mainly in jingles. Writing and building have a lot in common, says Weinhardt, who wears suspenders that look like big, bright yellow rulers.
Everything about carpentry is repetition and following steps. And words are like that. I mean, you build them one after the other, and it passes the time of day. Says Euripides to Euripides, these saws is dull and my fingers is froze. Looks like we's could use a couple of teas, says Euripides to Euripides. And so they stopped to warm their maws, make fast the files, and sharpen their saws. Says Euripides to Euripides, we need more boards to build these shelves. Says Euripides to Euripides, those boards ain't gonna rip themselves.
These days, Weinhardt's writing more than he used to. The poem you just heard, The Pit Saw, is a response to a challenge by his boss, Mark Regoven. Almost 2 years ago, Regoven walked into the carpenter's hangout, a tavern named James Gate, and he threw down a gauntlet.
An architect had emailed me a poem by Mark Turpin, who's a carpentry poet, and he's written a couple of books and everything. And Thursday nights, the carpenters in the area come in and have some pops after work. And I brought it in for like show and tell, and we all read the poem. And I said, we could do this. And everybody's pretty wordy, and I figured they'd take to that very well, putting words on paper. So, yeah, it was fun. It was like a little jam session.
The little jam session got big fast. Now the 20 or so carpenter poets organize well-attended readings at the bar twice a year with spontaneous gatherings in between.
Well, thank you once again for showing up for the Carpenter Poetry Participation Group. Hopefully everyone is going to be eager to read their own carpentry poem. Hi, my name is Fran Regan. Titled it Carpenter's Confession. Show me the craftsman, and I will show you 100 more who, like myself, fell into the trade by default. Men and women who embarked.
The styles of poetry here run the gamut. So do the degrees of technicality and seriousness. But all of the poems are about carpentry. That's rule number one. Siobhan Murphy has a thing for limericks and says she was an apprentice when she rose to the challenge.
I put it off and put it off and put it off, and finally, I think I wrote it on a bar napkin.
For this night's event, though, Murphy wrote her untitled poem in advance.
If I had to name it, I guess I would name it Difficult Angle.
And what's it about?
Angle insecurity.
Angle envy?
Angle envy, yeah. This carpenter is working a hard angle, and it's got my panties all in a tangle. I'm thinking if I could just wrangle my tongue from its constant dangle, I'd figure out how I might not mangle this, a most difficult angle. I'll use one of many a tool and try my damnedest not to look like a fool. But at the base of my stool, the drool is beginning to form a pool. But this carpenter knows how to keep her cool. Just remember the bevel rule, and you'll cut it like a jewel.
Bar napkins are popular media for carpenter poems, but Joe Bergen says he prefers the material of his trade.
I always write them down on a piece of 2x4 and save them for later.
Bergen is a driving force behind the carpenter poets. He's written many poems over the years. A few, he says, are about his work.
To me, it was very satisfying writing about what you do every day. I think the cowboy poets do the same, and we feel very akin to them. They're sort of our brothers and sisters in that kind of literary endeavor.
Well, it's not surprising. We're talking about people who have the same profession and who gather together like cowboy poets do, and perhaps they'll be published one day in an anthology.
William Corbett is a poet and publisher who teaches writing at MIT. Corbett says the cowboy and carpenter poets are unique today because so many poets are teachers, and usually they aren't writing about their jobs. But even so, does Corbett think an anthology of carpenter poetry is publishable?
Absolutely. Now, what kind of reception it will have, I don't know. They've started to publish already. They're publishing as soon as they open their mouths in front of a group of people that includes more than just themselves.
Hello?
Hello?
I'm Melissa Keith. Okay, this is called Watch Wood Teaches. I am wood, and I love when I am at the artisan's nimble fingers, humble task. In your safe arms, before I am made for their extravagant needs. Spinning
talk
legs.
Of materials and tools saturate the poems, also customer relations, camaraderie, and big paydays. Structural memory is at the heart of Bill Thibodeau's piece titled Too Slow for Demolition. Thibodeau is one of the two published poets in the group.
It's the movement of time, the skill of past carpenters, and the stories and voices that flow through a stream of generations, when heard by the pure of heart, voices that thunder like Brahman, within and without these plastered walls and ceilings, that light my eyes and guide my hands. No, I don't make a very good demo, man. I'm just too slow. I owe them that much.
There's little stories in all these houses, and the people who build those houses, are they still alive? Are they dead? You know, they meant something at one time. They just don't disappear in the works there. So the poem about me taking things down, I just didn't want to go in there with a bulldozer and knock it down. I thought that I owe them some honor, in a sense, just to go in there with a little respect.
The carpenter poets clearly respect their trade, their poems, and each other. But Joe Bergen says rule number two stipulates no judging.
Some heckling is certainly encouraged, but no critiquing.
This is J.D. Bergen's work. It's one of my favorite poems I ever heard. I broke the rule. I did a job I could see from my house. Twice. One nearly drove me to madness and bankruptcy. The other one turned out nice.
Fun, affection, and a common cause feed this phenomenon. Gauntlet thrower Mark Regovin says he'd like to see the poetry bug spread throughout his industry.
I would actually like this to be from the perspective of, for instance, a building inspector, a plumber, a homeowner. I would like every aspect of the whole process to weigh in on with a poem.
And who knows, maybe some inspectors, homeowners, and even painters out there might be willing to rise to Regovin's latest challenge.
Here now is Andrea Shea. To see pictures of the Carpenter Poets and learn more about them, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.